Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Few people have taught me more, brought more intelligence to bear in general, and rendered greater public service to our country in this present phases of the war for the free world than our guest, I'm very pleased to say, for this full hour. He is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, one of the country's preeminent authorities on a whole host of issues involving our national security. I sort of lump them together under the rubric of the strategic threats we face and what we need to do about them. He has served in the Central Intelligence Agency as an analyst specializing in these matters. He's been for many years a key member of the professional staff of several congressional efforts, including the House Armed Services Committee, and also the Congressional EMP Threat Commission for quite some time. He is the author of several very important books on different subjects, many of them having to do with the phenomenon of electromagnetic pulse, or EMP, including his most recent book, just hot off the presses, EMP Manhattan Project, Organizing for Survival Against an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe, now available from Amazon. Peter Pry, it is so good to have you back. Welcome, and thank you for giving us a full hour of your time. It's really an honor.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
I thought I'd start with some insights that I took away as I was sitting next to you from a very interesting briefing that we both attended earlier this week on Capitol Hill. And we'll talk about the substance of the briefing in terms of what it's educating us all about and the prescription that it particularly involved. But before we do that, Peter, I'd like to just talk with you a little bit about insights from the briefers, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, and the Director of the Missile Defense Agency, about the threat we're facing, the strategic missile threat in particular that we're facing today. Again, you have a wealth of experience on the subject, so I know you could have given those lectures as well as received them, but talk about what our audience should understand about the character of the challenges that we're increasingly facing in this war for the free world.
Yes, I thought that the Missile Defense Roundtable that they had was actually a historic moment for a number of reasons, including the fact that they talked about the NPR going back from the missile threat to the overall threat environment that we face. You know, throughout the Obama administration, Russia and China were not considered enemies. They were considered competitors. But for the 8 years of the Obama administration, people like you and me and others who've been watching the geopolitical developments have saying they were wrong about that, that in fact China and Russia regard us as enemies, and that we're back into an era like in the 19th century of great power competition. These guys are like the way Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire was before World War I. You know, where they consider themselves to be the have-not states because the global order, a rules-based global order, as they refer to it, one run by international law, try to respect the United Nations, which is dominated by the United States, or made possible by the United States, I should say, and not really dominated by us, but facilitated by us, so that there'd be fairness and rules for all the countries to go by, is being challenged by Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. And finally, there's recognition in this administration, in the nuclear posture review, in the national security statements, that these countries do regard us as enemies. And it's not just a matter of competitors or even friendly competition, but they are out to change the world order in a way to favor themselves, to basically knock off the United States, which is the global sheriff, the great power that upholds the current rules-based international order, and replace it with another one. And their chief instrument for doing this is through nuclear missiles, which is the most powerful technological instrument in our particular era of history, the growing threat from nuclear missiles. And Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran all know this and are all developing those kinds of threats.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the specifics of that, because you've written extensively, including for our Center for Security Policy, an important occasional paper on a class of weapons that I think you've characterized, as have others, as doomsday weapons, now being brought into the Russian inventory. Dr. Peter Pry, talk a little bit about what the Russians now are doing in terms of modernizing their strategic forces broadly, and specifically with respect to some of these weapons that are clearly designed to terrify, as well as to inflict mass destruction.
Yes, I think that last most point you make about terrifying is particularly important, because one of the things that makes nuclear weapons so powerful and important is the ability to win without war. People often forget we managed to win the Cold War without firing a shot because we deterred the Soviet Union by keeping winning the arms race, or at least keeping pace with the arms race, really winning it with the strategic defense initiative, space-based defenses that would have rendered nuclear missiles obsolete had we deployed it. That's one of the things that makes nuclear weapons and nuclear missiles so potent and powerful. It enables you to win without war by fear, and if you can't win that way, by their actual application. But on March 1st, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, went on television and basically told the world about a series of new nuclear weapons, including a doomsday machine that they had developed. The one you're referring to there is called Poseidon, and it's basically this artificially intelligent robot submarine armed with a 100-megaton weapon that they advertise as being capable of making nuclear radioactive tsunamis, that could be over 300 feet high and that would flood the coasts of the United States, which is where most of our population and industrial facilities are located. I have questioned. I think that it does have that purpose, but it probably has other purposes as well, like going after our ballistic missile submarines at sea, which are the most survivable leg of our nuclear triad. It's the one part of our triad they weren't able to destroy during the Cold War, but this thing would be able to do that by trailing our ballistic missile submarines that are deployed at sea, because a 100-megaton warhead would generate a tremendous shockwave underwater that could travel hundreds of kilometers and put submarines at risk.
So you wouldn't even need to know precisely where they were, as long as you had some broad area of the ocean as its target. And this, again, Peter Pry, is part of what makes this whole topic so unthinkable, is that the kind of mass destruction that would be involved were these weapons to be unleashed simply boggles the mind, but it is the height of folly for us not to be thinking about them. Peter, we have to pause for just a moment. When we come back, I want to talk with you a little bit about what the Chinese have been doing in terms of greatly intensifying the threat they now pose to us. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, one of the country's foremost experts on many aspects of the strategic threats we're facing these days. You probably saw his appearance. It's been rebroadcast at least once that I know of on the Mark Levin program, Sunday evenings at Fox News. Tour de force, really, of Peter Pry and Mark talking about some of the issues that we're discussing here today. We're very pleased to have the opportunity to do so at some length with Peter. And Peter, we were going through quickly some of the most worrying aspects of this buildup on the part of the Russians. I do want to get to some of the other threats, but there's another one that you wanted to mention in particular. Tell us about it.
Yes, the Satan II heavy ICBM, which is a clear first strike weapon, you know, designed to carry at least 14. Some estimates are up to 40 warheads. They would only require 50 of these missiles to basically take out all of the U.S. strategic bomber bases, our ICBM silos, and missile submarine pens in North America. So with 50 weapons armed with this new Satan II, you'd be able to do a disarming first strike. It's just another example of the growing missile threat. On China, the panel, the missile defense panel, was most concerned about China's development of hypersonics, which they have tested 26 times, a new hypersonic warhead, which poses very serious challenges for our national missile defenses. We also can't see it coming through normal ballistic missile early warning radars, and it also potentially poses a first strike capability against us. You know, it's which is why they were talking about going to space. In addition to the hypersonic threat, I mean, this is it's a reentry vehicle that skims along the surface of the atmosphere. It doesn't follow a classic arcing ballistic trajectory. And so it's out of sight of a lot of the ballistic missile early warning radars that would be looking for something like this that would be coming through space against the cold background of space, because basically it's riding along the top of the atmosphere. It's also, because it's on a depressed trajectory like that, it can get to targets a lot faster. And it, of course, travels at hypersonic speeds, you know, 10, 16 times the speed of sound. So you have the benefits of a ballistic missile reentry vehicle combined with something like a supersonic cruise missile that's skimming along the top of the atmosphere. It's a whole new weapons concept that hasn't existed before in the Cold War that both Russia and China are developing.
And Undersecretary Mike Griffin described this as the fruit of technology that we had done pathbreaking research on and then basically did not take forward, at least until very recently. The Chinese have, as you say, tested it dozens of times and have begun operationalizing and weaponizing this thing. So this is a present danger, to be sure.
Exactly. It's a potential game changer, Frank. And looking at the bigger picture of this, one of the things that makes it so worrisome is Russia and China are getting out ahead of us with a range of new strategic nuclear and missile technologies that have no counterparts in the United States. The United States doesn't have a hypersonic missile system. We don't have anything like a Satan II heavy ICBM. You know, we don't really have a means of countering the Poseidon that we were talking about before, because the United States has basically been living off the capital, off the technologies and the weapon systems that were built during Ronald Reagan. You know, our warheads are over 25 years old. You know, we haven't tested them in a quarter century, and we're basically trying to deter, and if we got into a war, we'd be trying to defeat our adversaries with deterrent systems that are a quarter century old.
And I have concerns. I have to say, Peter Pry, that the deterrent effectiveness of those systems, for the reasons you've mentioned, is woefully inadequate and may even be emboldening these adversaries, as they have built up such formidable capabilities, to think they can, well, behave aggressively at the very least, if not in a preemptive offensive attack. When you add all of that in with the fact that the North Koreans and the Iranians have also been beavering away at ballistic missiles and nuclear weapon systems, this is a very challenging environment indeed. And just quickly characterize, if you would, the piece of this threat from particularly these rogue nations, but to some extent from the others as well, that is of concern, particularly as you've addressed it in several of your books, including your new one, EMP Manhattan Project.
Right. I think you're absolutely right that the failure of the United States to modernize and maintain a robust deterrent is being exploited, not just by the Russians and Chinese, but it also explains why rogue states like North Korea and Iran think they can take advantage of the situation. If you think about the North Korean threat, even though they have only a small number of ICBMs, it doesn't take that much to be able to have very significant impact on our nuclear capabilities with a small number of weapons. We only have, for example, 3 strategic bomber bases, just 3, down from 45 during the Cold War. So 3 North Korean ICBMs could basically take out an entire leg of the triad. On a day-to-day basis, we have only 2. Most of our submarines are at port. There's only 2 of those. So if you had 5 ICBMs, you could get two-thirds of the U.S. nuclear triad. And with 1 warhead, 1 weapon, you could do an EMP attack over all of CONUS.
The continental United States.
Yes, on the ability to command and control our nuclear forces. And therefore, you know, with something like as little as 6 nuclear weapons from a North Korea or an Iran when they get the bomb, I think they've got it already, you know, you could prosecute a very effective first strike against the United States that would take out, you know, 2/3 of the triad legs and possibly paralyze the rest of the forces with EMP, electromagnetic pulse, so that they wouldn't be able to execute at all. And this is how far behind we've gotten and how dangerous the situation is. So even North Korea and Iran are starting to calculate that they can exploit our self-imposed weakness. You know, it was a huge mistake, a huge strategic error for multiple administrations, but particularly the Clinton and Obama administrations, to neglect keeping pace with the Russians and Chinese. We used to have a huge advantage over them technologically, and that's been allowed. We've thrown it away.
We've given it away, it seems. They've picked up on or ripped off a lot of these technologies. And that does bring us to the next topic that I wanted to cover with you, Peter Pry. We were together on Capitol Hill when the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance sponsored this congressional roundtable with, again, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy John Rood, Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering Mike Griffin, and Lieutenant General Sam Greaves, the director of the Missile Defense Agency. And they went through some of this litany that you've just covered with us and used it to help explain why the United States must take steps to deploy in space effective sensors and missile defenses to protect us against these emerging threats. Talk a little bit about the takeaway as you saw it from that important conversation.
Well, I said hallelujah about this because it's about time. Finally, Ronald Reagan's vision of a strategic defense initiative, the idea of space-based missile defenses that would be able to intercept in the boost phase, in mid-course, and then during the reentry phase, basically from space, you get 3 opportunities to take out a missile, which is much more effective than the very limited national missile defense the United States has today, which is not adequate to deal. In fact, it was deliberately designed so that it couldn't deal capably with the Chinese and Russian threats. It was only supposed to be able to deal with North Korea. And that's due to the Clinton administration's influence and those people who never wanted us to have a national missile defense. So we've got a dumbed down national missile defense. And it was never adequate to deal with Russia and China. Reagan's vision, we finally have another chance at realizing it, was to render nuclear missiles obsolete.
Impotent and obsolete, if I recall his phrase. Yes.
Yes, that's right. Just as the Russians and Chinese are trying to change the game with these first strike weapons that would enable to win a nuclear war or threaten to win a nuclear war and thereby win without even having to fight the war, we can change the game in our favor with space-based defenses that give the advantage to the defender. One of the misconceptions out there, I think, you know, is that a space-based missile defense, you know, has to be 100% effective in order to be credible, which is utter nonsense. The requirements for somebody trying to launch a first strike are very high. You know, the damage goals for Russia and for China would be a 90% kill probability against, let's say, our missile silos and our bomber bases. So if you were able to diminish their confidence by 10 or 15% in their ability to achieve those damage goals, you would be able to possibly deter them from launching that first strike in the first place.
You know, this is so important, Peter. I remember vividly being in the middle of debates back in the day when I was in the Reagan administration, and there were these very concerted efforts. You know, we're talking about people who opposed the president's policies in the Trump administration. Well, I remember vividly people who were opposing Ronald Reagan's desire to have defenses against missiles, arguing that we had to have cost effectiveness at the margin, as they put it, which meant that the missile defenses had to be cheaper than the missile threats. And that was a very high bar. But the point that I made, which you've just said so eloquently, is you don't need to actually be able to defeat every single one of the attacking warheads or missiles. You need to disrupt, make unpredictable the nature of that strategic laydown, as they call it, that threat. And if you do, if you can introduce uncertainty as to what its effectiveness will be, it can have a very powerful effect on the willingness of a targeteer or, you know, somebody interested in mounting a first strike, because they simply can't be certain that it'll pay off. This is a hugely important insight. And Peter, we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about both what we need to be doing to realize that Reagan vision with real missile defenses in space, as well as what you would recommend as a serious student of these matters and practitioner for that matter as well, of strategic offensive deterrence in this critical window. And we'll talk about that and more with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined for this full hour of a very, very important conversation with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. I have had the privilege of knowing and working with Peter Pry for decades, I believe now, and have admired his patriotism, his savvy, technical and policy savvy, and his tenacity, more than that of just about anybody else I can think of, in or out of government. He has made contributions throughout government service and now in his post-government role as the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, the Congressional Advisory Board. But his published works, which include Apocalypse Unknown and Electric Armageddon, as well as his brand new book, EMP Manhattan Project, are a really required reading. And we'll be talking more about the subjects they address shortly. But Peter, I did want to come back to sort of the bottom line, I guess, of the briefing that we both received, among others, on Capitol Hill last Tuesday, where we learned about the planning that is being done now in the executive branch, the Defense Department specifically, to fulfill congressional direction to deploy capable, robust, global missile defenses, a very, very important development. Talk about that.
Yes, it's a hugely important development, and not least because Congress is the initiator of this. It's really the only reason the Department of Defense, you know, has been doing it. Well, it's not the only reason. I believe President Trump shares this vision with Congress. This is why he wants to establish a U.S. Space Force as a separate independent branch, which I also think is long overdue. Why was Reagan's vision of the SDI neglected for so many years by the Air Force? I think it was because the Air Force and all the other services, you know, gave priority to their bombers and to the particular weapon systems that their services were relying upon. And our space assets, like our nuclear deterrent, were allowed to basically wither away and age. And we didn't exploit our technological advantage that we have still over our adversaries in space. And this is why it's necessary to have a U.S. Space Force coming from the presidential level combined with the congressional support we now have for for space-based defenses. This is something that hasn't existed since the Reagan administration. So it's a pivotal time for us. And I think to impress upon the audience about just how important it is. It was an issue I would have liked to have raised myself and tried to at the last minute in the roundtable, but I didn't get called upon for a question. This is a sea change. If we can go to space-based defenses, it can change the technological competition away from offensive missile systems to defense, where the defender has the advantage. And this is the right throughout the Cold War, throughout the nuclear missile age, we've been relying roughly on what's been called mutual assured destruction, the threat of killing millions of the enemy's people and destroying their military forces to deter them from attacking us. With defenses, that changes dramatically. It could change the strategic situation to what I like to call strategic assured national existence, where instead of depending upon threatening the destruction of other nations, we can actually protect ourselves and destroy enemy missiles and warheads instead of destroying enemy peoples as our first resort. And this is more consistent with our Judeo-Christian civilization, which is one of the reasons, I think, why we haven't been able to keep pace with it's not a popular thing. Nuclear weapons, nuclear missiles have never been a popular thing in the United States on either side of the aisle. And getting the political willpower to keep these forces modernized is something that we have not been able to do since the end of the Cold War. And whether we will be able to do it in a timely fashion is still out there. When you look at the new programs we have for building new ballistic missile systems, new ICBMs, and new bombers, they're still years away from us. We're looking out past 2030 before a lot of these things start coming in line in large numbers. That's a long way off, and the threat is here and now. You know, Ambassador Cooper and other experts believe that if we had a crash program, a Manhattan Project for space-based defenses, for example, as we hope they would do, we could actually deploy these space-based defenses at relatively low cost. $20 billion, you know, is a number that's a realistic number, you know, that we could do these before the end of President Trump's second term. And this would be a game changer and possibly stave off a World War III that the bad guys appear to be practicing, even as you and I speak, Frank.
This is really an important thing that I wanted to, let's just turn to that for a moment, Peter Pry, because when we think about the imperative of having effective defenses, including in space, when we think about the imperative of overhauling and upgrading our obsolescent nuclear deterrent, our offensive capabilities, it's certainly that compelling need for those offensive and defensive capabilities is made manifest in the war games, the exercises that are now being conducted jointly by Russian and Chinese military personnel in what's called Vostok 18. Let's talk a little bit about what we know about that exercise and its implications, Peter.
It's the largest military exercise conducted by Russia since Zapad 81 during the height of the Cold War. Zapad 81 can also involve hundreds of thousands of troops. Zapad 81 means West 81, and it was basically a plan for a nuclear World War III to invade and take over European NATO. This one, Vostok 18, means East 18. It's being practiced in Siberia, but that doesn't mean that that the object is to prosecute a war that is only limited to Siberia. They're doing that because under the Conventional Forces in Europe treaty, they can do anything they want in terms of exercises without having NATO monitors to look at what's going on. Sergei Shoigu, the chief of the Russian general staff, you know, describes this as having 300,000 troops, 36,000 armored vehicles of all kinds, 3,000 aircraft. This is an exercise, and at the same time, they haven't officially mentioned it, but they've got the Russian fleet in the Mediterranean getting ready to launch strikes against Syria in a real world, and that's probably part of the exercise too. So this is basically, you know, a global practice for a nuclear World War III, and it's been going on since the end of August, still going on as we speak.
The other thing that has, I don't know if it's true in this case, but I would be surprised if it isn't. It certainly has in a number of other of these exercises, Peter Pry, is that the guy playing the role of Vladimir Putin is Vladimir Putin. You know, you actually have him personally overseeing and calling the shots on nuclear strikes in Europe or in Asia or against the United States in practice. But you know what they say, Peter, you practice the way you intend to fight. And that's what quite concerned is an evidence in this exercise. Peter, I want to just talk finally in this case about the extent to which we are sort of being deluded into thinking that we can talk people like the Russians or the Chinese, or for that matter, honestly, I think the North Koreans, to say nothing of the Iranian regime, out of the importance they attach to nuclear weaponry and the ability to attack us with such weaponry. Talk us through quickly sort of the doctrinal or even ideological attachment that these countries have and our experience with trying to get arms control arrangements that will denuclearize them.
Well, first, I'd like to talk about the ideological attachment that the Western democracies have always had to the belief that you can negotiate your way out of a future war, that you can talk someone out of these threats, and that a piece of paper can substitute for military preparedness. That is the same kind of thinking that led to World War II under Neville Chamberlain, thinking he could talk Hitler and that we could also have treaties like the Washington Naval agreements with Imperial Japan before World War II, which didn't work, which they cheated on them. We knew during the Reagan administration that the Soviet Union had cheated on every major arms control agreement that they signed with the United States, but the Department of State to this day keeps classified the General Advisory Committee Arms Report on that, because we have such a fixation ourselves on the belief that we can use treaties and arms control to contain these threats.
One of our frequent guests is Dr. Mark Schneider, who you've worked with over the years, as have I, Peter Pry, and you know he's living proof of the difficulty that the truth tellers have had in overcoming the insistence, notably by the State Department, but usually by various White Houses as well, to lowball the evidence of noncompliance by the Soviet Union or others, and sort of just paper it all over as though it's not a problem that these treaties wind up being one-way streets, you know, with us conforming and the bad guys that threaten us not. And Peter, so when you're watching President Trump trying to get some sort of new understanding implemented with the North Koreans, for example, what would your advice be on the advisability of pursuing that?
I wrote an article back in September urging the president that if he not to go into negotiations with North Korea, because it would go the way of Bush and Obama and the Clinton administrations before that, that they would just use the negotiations to buy time so they could build enough ICBMs and enough warheads so that we would have to accept North Korea as a fact and end up having a mutual assured destruction relationship with North Korea, which ultimately will end badly. If we want North Korea to have no nuclear weapons, we will have no alternative, you know, but to launch some kind of disarming strike, the way the Israelis disarmed Saddam Hussein and Bashar al-Assad in Syria by making limited strikes.
Peter, hold this thought. We have to break. We will be right back with more with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the final installment of our very important, very special, very informative, very alarming, really, conversation with one of the country's truly preeminent authorities, and I, well, call him a national treasure when it comes to matters involving our strategic vulnerabilities and what must be done to mitigate them. Peter has been sharing with us his insights into the various threats we're facing. I did want to come to the focus of his new book, EMP Manhattan Project, Organizing for Survival Against an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe. You can find it now at Amazon. It is one of several books that he has written with a similar warning that our grid is vulnerable to both man-induced and naturally occurring phenomena that could bring it down with truly catastrophic, I think he would say, nation-ending effects. Peter, tell us a little bit about how we have found ourselves in a state where something that we absolutely must have for the survival of our country and certainly the vast majority of its population, is so vulnerable?
Well, we've never protected the electric grid or any of the other life-sustaining critical infrastructures from EMP or from cyber attacks, for that matter. EMP, for the audience, part of the audience may not have heard of it, can happen from the sun, a natural EMP in the form of geomagnetic superstorm like the 1859 Carrington event, which would destroy electric grids worldwide and put billions of lives at risk. And it will be inevitable. It'll happen 100% for sure someday. Another way of making an EMP is a nuclear weapon detonated in space. This isn't the Cold War-type nuclear attack that we envision that blows up a missile silo or has a mushroom cloud over a city. The weapon is detonated in the vacuum of space, so high that if you were on the ground, you wouldn't even hear the explosion. There'd be no blast that would reach you. There'd be no fallout. The only thing that would happen would be this electromagnetic pulse, which is a super energetic radio wave that can destroy electronics across an entire continent, like the United States and Canada. North Korea actually has two satellites orbiting over North America now, the KMS-3 and KMS-4, that are at the optimum altitude for making an EMP attack if they were nuclear armed. And the EMP commission on which I serve recommending taking out these satellites because we don't know if they're nuclear armed or not. Tying this in to the earlier part of our conversation, Frank, EMP and cyber warfare, they are part. One could argue that we're already under attack and at war with Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. The way they envision war unfolding is to start with cyber warfare and that would escalate to a nuclear EMP attack to paralyze our command and control, take out our electric grid, basically, that's a way of bringing a civilization to its knees and neutralizing an adversary's military forces, very quickly. And then, if a big traditional war was necessary, going forward with nuclear and missile strikes from missiles and bombers and actual ground invasion to take control of territory, for example, in NATO Europe, cyber warfare, an EMP, nuclear warfare, conventional forces invading countries, these are all seamlessly related, different stages of a conflict. And part of that conflict has already been ongoing, actually, for many years, from all of these potential adversaries, from Russia. They have been testing our reaction to these cyber attacks. And EMP is part of cyber warfare, the ultimate cyber weapon in their military doctrine is the nuclear EMP attack. So when we see our response to this has been so, we've been so puzzled and bewildered and flat-footed about, well, what do we do about these cyber warfare attacks when the Chinese steal, for example, millions of files? At one point in the Obama administration, in the last 2 years of the Obama administration, the Russians actually made a cyber attack against the Department of Defense that shut down the electronic communication systems for the Joint Chiefs of Staff for 2 weeks. They also made an attack on the White House. We never responded. We never did anything, never retaliated against that. And frankly, we don't know how. And that figures into their plans because they're saying they can see that we don't have a plan to defend ourselves and to come back against that. And if you follow their pattern, they've been getting bolder.
Yeah, no, it's emboldening them when they don't find there are costs associated with this kind of aggressive behavior. So, Peter Pry, let me ask you, we've got the evidence, hard evidence, that the Russians and Chinese and North Koreans, even the Iranians, have been not only thinking about all of this and planning doctrinally, but they've actually been experimenting with, exercising, if you will, the capabilities to get inside of ours and to some extent, in some of these cases, others' electric grids with the potential to disrupt, at the very minimum, if not destroy, significant power generation and distribution capabilities. Just very briefly, Peter, what is a United States of America like in the event that that is accomplished, whether it's through cyber means or sabotage or through an electromagnetic pulse attack of one kind or another, or a naturally occurring phenomenon. Is it in America at all, at least as we've known it to this point?
Well, that's the short answer, Frank. There isn't in America. You know, the EMP Commission estimated that up to 90% of our population could die in a year from starvation, disease, and societal collapse with a nationwide blackout that lasted 1 year. So there would be no America. Just with the EMP and cyber attacks alone, you know, you could basically win World War III, and that's part of their doctrine. Their plan would call for winning this kind of cyber warfare that uses cyber and EMP in 24 hours and replacing one civilization with another in 24 hours. But in addition to that, they also have developed these capabilities to execute a classical nuclear World War III with missile strikes and large conventional forces that could invade our adversaries. And this is all part of an escalating game plan that they have. The leading edge of that game plan, as I said before, we're already experiencing it with these cyber attacks. The way we should think of the cyber, you know, it's like during World War II, you know, the Germans had a motorcycle corps, you know, that would range out in front of their armored spearheads and out in front of the Luftwaffe to look for weaknesses in the Allied lines. You know, when cyber attacks are happening, we ought not to think that it's just limited to the cyber. It's the equivalent of a German motorcyclist on a hill overlooking that French village. Behind him is all the rest of this stuff that we've been talking about.
Coming our way. Yeah. Peter Pry, let me ask you finally, when we see all of this as clear as day before us, the buildups, the doctrines, the exercises, the utilization of some of these capabilities, surely those currently in positions of responsibility in the United States government are aware of all of it as well. Again, we've talked a little bit about, you know, the effort that's now beginning to put missile defenses into place in space. We've talked about a long-term, unfortunately, strategic modernization program. But what is being done by the Trump administration, as best we can tell, about enhancing the resiliency of our most critical of critical infrastructures, the electric grid?
The president deserves enormous credit for trying to lead on this issue. He's the first president in his national security strategy to basically direct the U.S. government that it shall be one of their goals to protect the electric grid and our other life-sustaining critical infrastructures from cyber warfare, from EMP, and from physical sabotage. But it's not enough for the president to lead anymore. He's been joined by the Congress, I should add. Senator Ron Johnson deserves enormous credit for passage of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act that directs the Department of Homeland Security to come up with a strategy and to work with the utilities to protect the electric grid from EMP.
Peter Vincent Pry, author, pundit, analyst, leader on so many matters of vital importance to our national security. Thank you, my friend. Good to talk with you. Welcome the chance, as always, to talk with the rest of you, and we'll look forward to doing so again on Monday. Come back to us again, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.